Welcome to VarmBlog, where our aim is to give you the best in analysis in philosophy, political economy, history, art, culture, and geopolitics from a left-wing and socialist-friendly perspective. We aim to bring you different perspectives from different walks of life and to have you educate yourself what to do with what you learned here. We do not aim to give you prefabricated and easy answers. Abandon all hope, ye who subscribe here, for you will learn, and it will be your responsibility what you do. And with that, let's begin today's episode. Hello, and welcome to VarmBlog. And today I'm talking to Nico Villarreal about, let's just call it the haze of Bidenomics. I don't really know what to call it. We're going to be dealing with profit rates, current trends in left economics from the likes of MMT and Seth Ackerman, the petite bourgeoisie, all kinds of stuff are coming up today. So, and I'm going to, of course, link the articles we refer to by Nico in the show notes, obviously. So, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. I've been stressed lately, but finally got some chance to relax. I've had a flurry of work that I did when I wrote those last two articles. Economics is one of those things where it really seizes my attention, and I have to get whatever ideas out of me before I lose it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and also it's something that I think the information can be difficult to parse in real time. So you kind of have to act very quickly.
Sure.
When you get data, and I find the current data problems kind of interesting.
It's funny because, like, certainly there's lots of data points that I'm thinking about recently. Like, I try to keep up to date with everything that comes out, especially with the GDP national account stuff as that comes out. But a lot of the things that I've been obsessing with recently have kind of been slow burning, that I've been thinking about a long time, and only recently has something happened where it made me realize something. So there was you call the stream like a haze of economics under Biden. There's one like particular thing. There's lots of particular things with Biden in the economy and how that's being affected, but the thing that I had been thinking about the longest was the relationship of antitrust and class politics, and how that's being picked up by the Biden administration. Because I recognized that it was back in 2019 or so that this was a thing that was becoming that the Trump administration had really brought to the fore, and then the Democrats, who had not really been doing anything on it, kind of started picking up on it too. And this was stronger for the social Democrat wing, the Bernie-crat wing of the Democratic Party, but now it was a mainstream thing because Biden was talking about it during his transition, right? And now we're seeing everything that he's doing about it. It made me realize that this is a very firm bipartisan consensus. And I had this thought when I was thinking about this originally, that the tech companies would really try to do something about this, that they wouldn't just stand by and let it happen. And they really haven't done anything out of the ordinary to prevent it. Antitrust suit going against Amazon, and lots of other things are being considered as well. But the idea that it would get this far is, and the tech companies just wouldn't do anything about it was like, I didn't think that was how it was going to play out.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this antitrust stuff too, because for like literally two decades we've kind of ignored antitrust laws just entirely. Now there is a broad bipartisan consensus on actually doing something about it. I completely agree with you on that. And what makes that more interesting is that it's actually part of a large panoply of things that there's a kind of hidden bipartisan consensus on. And I say hidden because it seems like neither side wants to admit how much continuity there is on economic policy between the two parties right now. You'll get lip service in opposition to either on the Democratic side to something like a more social democratic, you know, whatever this post neoliberalism is, and you'll get lip service on the Republican side to like a freer market or to the, you know, the Liberty Caucus, but they largely actually have come to consensus on infrastructure. They've come to a consensus on, not that they can do it, but they come to a consensus about its need. They've come to a consensus on antitrust law. They've come to a consensus on reshoring. They've come to a consensus on limiting immigration and not using that as a way to lower certain kinds of wage sectors anymore.
I mean, the craziest thing about all this is that where this came from, because Trump was the one who was the leader on all these things. And like the fact that he was the one who was moving policy on this, and now that these are all things that are bog standard in Washington, the Trump tax policy, the Trump trade policy, the Trump infrastructure, and all like the first really big insane spending package happened during the pandemic under Trump before Biden got into power.
And actually, arguably, even though there's tons that we could talk about, it's mishandling the PPP loans, et cetera.
Yeah.
The first spending bills in some way were more progressive because they are what enabled the most progressive part of this, of the bailouts, which was expanding unemployment the way it was expanded.
Yeah.
Like which when paired with a Biden change of raising the federal minimum wage for federal contractors and employees, not, you know, legislatively for the general public, really did set pace for a low end wage increase. And when I say low end, I mean like, you know, entry level workers have seen pretty significant wage increases in a lot of fields. What's interesting about that though is it doesn't go up very far. Like, so you've seen a lot of increase of base pay, but like mid-tier pay has actually been somewhat consistent. It's going up, but like far less pegged to inflation. Then we had the great AI job apocalypse, which I'm not saying won't happen, but it's not happening as fast as we feared. The technology seems to have been underutilized or not utilized well in its rollout by these tech companies. And in fact, I've been surprised in general about two things. One is the amount of consensus that's hidden and everyone's like, oh, we're super divided. And I'm like, it seems like the division's actually distracting from what the consensus is in some ways.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think the important thing about this, at least the way that I've understood it, is that what really drove these changes is the militancy of the petty bourgeois in response to like a resurgent monopoly power and in general, like the trends of globalization, which was simmering a long time, but really took shape under Trump. Like Trump gave all of this coherency and like the an ideology. And like he was doing like the work of creating ideology and putting it into the state apparatus of this group. And I actually for the a long time, I didn't have too much specifics on like the data on how the economy has shifted between like small and large firms. Mm-hmm. I finally got some of like that data from the census, and like looking at how employment by firm size has shifted over the years since like 1978 or something, which was kind of a tease because it would have been really helpful to know what it looked like just like 10 years before that, to see how the 70s really transformed the economy. But the big takeaway, I mean, these numbers don't actually shift all that much because you're just looking at employment, not like the income and so on. It's going to these different firms. But the clear trend that you see is that the small and medium sized businesses were really ascendant up until like the early to mid 2000s. And then like the biggest firms, 1,000 more employees, start to take off, like return back to their highs at the very start of this process. And I think that this really is what kicked off this whole, like the political situation that we have now, and why, why this became the bipartisan consensus right now.
Well, I find your focus on the petite bourgeoisie interesting because the left right now, the left, whatever the fuck that is, I'm just going to start always using the left in scare quotes because I don't know what it means anymore. And if I don't know what it means, neither do most people. But there's been a movement around a certain coterie of not quite post-left, third generation post-left, actually, to be clear, because that's mean different things in time, too. I hate the way these words get recycled dumbly. But not quite post-left, but almost, you know, social democrat adjacent, like quasi-workerism that's emerged out of people like Catherine Liu, yeah. Class Unity Caucus, etc. That I have increasingly seen as like totally stuck on the idea of the PMC, a class that I don't even think is a class. Mm-hmm. Like, and people attack me because they're like, well, the PMC elites run everything. But when you ask them who it is, there's always a game with who they're referring to. Whereas it seems to me that there's two things going on. And I do think Kristen Parenti, of all people, actually did kind of hit this nail on the head. And I used it in your article on the petite bourgeoisie, which for people listening or watching will be in the show notes. I started seeing that maybe Michael Lind had a point, and this is not me endorsing Lind's politics, which are totally corporatist in the old sense of that word, but that it really did seem like there's a strata of former petite bourgeois who are now professionalized. So they are, we could call them labor aristocrats because they have government employees, highly unionized jobs. They're carteled. They have licensure. And then you have a very active petite bourgeois, right? And Lin says right now, I think he said this since the New Class War, that if you want to understand American politics, you have to understand the divisions between these two groups. I think that's broadly speaking true, with the concession that the PMC is a more confused category, which contains many petite bourgeois elements in it itself. Mm-hmm. And because of that, there's a mystification on the identity politics and cultural war stuff around this group as a means of getting ahead in, you know, very limited, you know, white collar kind of work. At the same time, these same people are often doing what the right wing does and actually
valorizing elements of the petite bourgeoisie as the working class without even acknowledging radical differences in the interest of these groups. And then also not dealing with, on top of that, a kind of lumpenization of a whole swath of the U.S. working class in deindustrialization. So mm-hmm. I don't mean they're true lumpen in that, you know, in the Marxist sense that they're like criminalized. I mean that people are in gig work and have to like work in precarious jobs that are highly alienated and isolated from each other, and actually kind of have to be, they're often going, and the same person will be a petite bourgeois part of the day and then be a wage earner a part of the day, and may even be partaking in the gray economy for part of the day. Making like clear class interest in organization much harder to do. And I think you even see that in the kinds of organizational attempts the left tends to do right now. They're not trying to, even though we have a union militancy, I think today I read there's more strikes going on right now than there has been in American history. Asterisk, not when you adjust for population size though, on asterisk, but still like there's real labor militancy right now, even if unions somehow aren't growing. And that leads me to a kind of question then. If the, like, let me put it this way. The semi-petite bourgeoisification of large parts of the economy are actually really interesting. So I'm just going to speak about a field I know a lot about. My family has been tied into auto dealerships in the mechanic sector for a long time. They can't get parts. They can't sell cars. And so a lot of the workers in downstream of the UAW right now are turning against the UAW.
Mm-hmm.
But part of the problem there is that they are piecemeal commission workers who also have a semi petite bourgeois, like the way they have to bill hours puts them in a semi petite bourgeois position. So even in these cases where these people by any Marxist definition are workers, but the structure of their work incentivizes them to act like petite bourgeoisie. And there's tons of them downstream of industrial workers, and there's more of them than there are the industrial workers. And so it's very hard to see how you generate a clear class politics out of that as a revolutionary subject. So your article thesis on the petite bourgeoisie as a revolutionary class and how this generated a consensus in response to it first under Trump. But the remarkable thing is that a lot of the more Democratic Party adjacent left has not really addressed is how fucking consistent.
And people don't realize that, like the petty bourgeois, small business owners, these people, while they prefer the Republicans, it's not overwhelming. It's like 60-40 or something like that, maybe not even that far. There's a lot of petty bourgeois people in the Democratic Party. But I think to hit on something deeper there is that there's this tendency, like I kind of used the like revolutionary class there. You could kind of put that in quotation marks, like that. But
I think you were actually kind of implying they were a counter-revolutionary class. But
well, here's the thing: is that there's a lot of people like the post-left people that you're pointing out. There's also like the patriotic socialist types, Haz and a lot of other people, Caleb Maupin, who basically picked up on this thing that the petty bourgeois is the class that is like the biggest problem right now for the state that has yet to be solved, which is how I frame it in the article, that there's a real thing that the people aren't imagining when talking about like January 6th or the trucker protests or the anti-lockdown people or whatever. These people actually are like anti like are a problem for the state. They are like that. So I see why people look to them as a revolutionary subject. But the problem with that is, like, is this the classical problems of that Marxists have always talked about with the petty bourgeoisie, and I've talked about it a lot, is that it's a, like, you can go back to like the 18th Brumaire, and Marx is talking about, like, the he talks about the French peasants. He, like, at this point, like, the petty bourgeois are still, like, supporting democratic struggle or whatever. They're basically, like, the like centrist libs in parliament or whatever are the like the less radical Republicans are basically what they're associated with at the time. But the way that Marx describes the peasants is something that I think perfectly describes like the petty bourgeois in America today and lots of parts in the world, which is that these people are atomized. They have, like, their little parcel that they own, and they do their work kind of on their own. They're not, like, in common. They're not in cooperation with society or at large, and they are they need strong leaders because they don't have, like, their own kind of collective politics. They look towards, like, Bonaparte in that situation, and that's another reason I think that Trump is a very Bonapartist figure, is that he is this, like, strong leader for an atomized, isolated, like, petty bourgeois class. It has these analogs to the French peasantry at the time. They can't create a better society. It's like as like trying to, because they can't, like one, they can't imagine anything beyond. They're trying to preserve bourgeois but social relations really, really hard, but they are the weakest link of, like, bourgeois society at the same time because of their economic situation.
Let's talk about that for a second, because there is also a left response to this. I think, you know, came out of Seth Ackerman's reply to Dylan Riley and Robert Brenner. Now, I have my critiques of the Brenner and Riley theses on Biden, one of which is they point out that most of what Biden has done is a response to Trump. And then they point out that correctly that Trump can't totally claim what he did because he had to keep, you know, neoliberal elements of his coalition in the coalition. But then they somehow read Biden as a new force of politics, and as a holder of neo-progressivism, whatever that means, which I think is silly. But one of the things that they do talk about, I don't love their idea of political capitalism, because capitalism's always been political. That's confused. But the thing they point out is it seems like we're attempting Keynesian management strategies on a low profit economy. And I guess Ackerman would consider himself a Marxist, even though he doesn't talk like one. But the modern monetary theorist and people and a lot of the social democrats like Seth Ackerman have been arguing that, no, the economy is doing really well. I mean, Freddie DeBoer came on my show and said he didn't understand why, you know, people felt like the economy was doing poorly under Biden. And I kept my mouth shut, but I was like, I can tell your Substack's doing well. because yes, GDP is about 3%, and that's historically high-ish. But when you look at the finer details of that, it paints a much more stagnant picture. And you picked up on this, and we'll I think I want to tie this back into your theses about the petty bourgeoisie and, you know, my observations about lumpenization. But you do tie this back into two things. One, you've looked at what's holding the banks solvent right now, and it's not what people think. And two, even though we haven't gone back to QE, so this is working in a different way, but there is a way in which, you know, the Fed looks like it's just plummeting actually right now. Furthermore, the actual profit rate, I will admit, I become skeptical that we actually completely, I've almost taken a Paul Maddock Jr. view of it, where like some of these things are hard to measure the way we measure them, unless it's very hard to talk about. But we do have proximity measures, and it seems to me that using just net GDP, even though in the long durée, that also indicates that there's a decline in the rates of profits, because net GDP is kind of, since the 60s, been between what, 3, like 1 and 5%, like pretty much perpetually. But it also seems to me that when you look at these other indicators, you start seeing that profits are not what they seem. And particularly when you start dealing in real commodities, and it's not just de-dollarization or whatever that is driving this. So would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I think that the, I think that the statistics on rate of profits are pretty good, that we like that. I mean, I reduce it to like a, to basically a different way of looking at the profit margin. Just don't worry about the capital stock, which Acumen was really focused on. But even like, I've also done some double checking on this. Like, when you use depreciation instead of the capital stock and you're just using flow measures, it will mirror the like same trajectory of what the capital stock is doing generally.
Can you explain what that means to listeners who might not understand you?
So like the, so when you invest in fixed capital, you have these things that are now on your balance sheet, you don't immediately count the cost of these things that you you bought as like as a business expense. They're investments, and they slowly get moved as expenses through depreciation, taking them off the balance sheet and onto your income statement as an expense. So the capital stock is this asset of like the fixed machinery, the fixed like the machinery equipment, all the kind of stuff that you need for the business, and depreciation is how that much that's used up. Specifically, Marx talks about how the amount that's used up, it has its value represented in the price of the, or the value of the final commodity. And that's, so it, when you look at income, you can divide it into like depreciation, wages, the surplus, which is what, which is reflected in actual national accounts, but like there's a more Marxist way of looking at it. I haven't even touched like turnover rates and stuff like that, but I'm hoping to look more into that into the future. The thing that like the thing that Ackerman was really like the technical critique he made of all these people saying that like the capital stock measures, like the depreciation rates were incorrect, was what he said. And this meant that capital stocks were different, and creating like a rate of profit that doesn't show like a tendency for profit rates to fall. But that's just not like the way he did it. He basically did like the, took the wrong data of so I actually looked back and I realized that if there was a correct set of data he could have used from the paper he cited, because basically it's just they took a new depreciation rate and applied it to this capital stock, and caused it to change drastically, because it was because the whole time that capital stock was created, it was up working under a different depreciation rate. So by introducing a new one, it had to rapidly change to adjust to that new outflow level. Whereas if you had applied that depreciation rate consistently for the whole time period that like you were tracking investment and had this capital stock, which the paper also does, it like applies this depreciation rate going back to 1901, then you get a totally different capital stock that is like more in line. Like you would get a measure that is very similar to other profit rate measures in terms of the shape that it takes, even if it's at a different level.
So to explain why this is important, it means that the contention that Seth Ackerman and a lot of modern monetary theorists, not all, but a lot, put out, that by basically increasing liquidity through fiscal policy, you can stimulate enough production to offset any tendency of the rate of profit to fall.
So fundamentally, like there's a couple big problems with that. Is that the first of all, you have to keep in mind that the Keynesian policy framework is what created like the big profitability crisis of the 70s.
Absolutely.
That should not be in contention. When you have the point of the economic stimulus is you're having rising wages. If you have rising wages, rising investment, particularly as a share of the economy, eventually you're going to run into a profitability crisis. That's just what's going to happen. Because the more investment that you have, the more capital stock, the more depreciation, and the more wages, obviously the less profit you're going to have. The idea, you can stimulate the economy to induce tighter labor markets, like through full employment, or if just full employment is your goal, you're still going to get tighter labor markets. The whole thing that, I am very open to all the kinds of possibilities here. I am even open to the possibility that what Biden's doing right now lays the foundation for a systemically higher wage growth and higher investment type of economy. The problem with that happening, it's a good problem to have, that it's the kind of problem that we as Marxists want, is that you're going to get to another profitability crisis because of that policy, because of that systemic framework. And the problem that Ackerman and people like him have is that they don't recognize that. They are fundamentally, because they're they're wedded to basically to capitalism. They're like Seth Ackerman. I actually liked him as I was becoming familiar with socialism. He was a he had this article basically elaborating a system of market socialism that I thought was really interesting and kind of I enjoyed it. But if you take that as your end goal, and you can't accept these, it's different once if you've actually eliminated the capitalist class. But the problem of what he's talking about right now is if you have a capitalist class, once you hit that limit, you're going to have to expropriate them in order to keep the gains that you have in terms of the income of society going to workers and to the means of production and so on. If you don't do that, you're going to get exactly what happened in the 70s and the 80s, which was the rise of neoliberalism, that you had to do all these things to take down workers' income, decrease investment rates. The thing is that because of what we did then, this is all connected back to the petty bourgeois, because one of the strategies of how to deal with this, this was very explicit in how the capitalism in the 70s and 80s worked, was that you took businesses and you cut off the unprofitable parts and had those be their own business, so that the big capitalists could preserve their profitability. And this created a whole new class of the petty bourgeois regional capitalists. Because really, we're talking about petty bourgeois, the leading elements of this are not people who have a small operation of two or three employees. That's actually been a decreasing part of the economy.
Yeah, that would be, we might even call that the petty bourgeois at this point.
Yeah. And honestly, I can respect that there's something emancipatory in just this very one or two people or just a small group of people who are trying to just make a living for themselves. Right. There's something dynamic about that or whatever.
Artisan consciousness. Artisan consciousness. And it, yes. And it is proletarianizing in a way because, like, their profits suck. But the thing is, they have the bust ass to get them. So,
But the thing is like what really we're talking about is a political and economic phenomenon are like people who have like 10, 20 up to even like 100 employees, maybe even more on like a regional level. There's different arrangements of like franchises are really big and stuff. But the point is that why these things became a thing is because they were the unprofitable parts of these bigger businesses. And what you were talking about earlier, the reason that car dealerships do that kind of thing of like the treating these people almost as like their own businesses, like is like almost as contractors or whatever, having their piecemeal and whatever. That's because like they don't want to take on the risk of those like of shifts in demand and whatever. They want to pass on as much of like the business risk to other people as they can. And when you've done that, and when you've atomized production in general, it makes society more vulnerable to profitability crises. So it took like the whole post-war period to get to the profitability crisis of the 70s. It would not take as long if we were to take that route again. It would happen much quicker, because the petty bourgeois is a militant political faction society now that has real power in setting the agenda in Washington, it would be a much bigger problem because now like these people are facing like an economic, an existential economic problem. And they have political power to do something about it. And right. We really didn't see what would, like, during the pandemic, we had PPE loans and all that stuff to make sure that didn't happen, to ameliorate over all of these, like, things. We still don't know exactly what that would look like in the post-2008 period.
Well, I think there's a bunch of black boxes opening up. There's the return of all the capital tied into student loans, which admittedly doesn't affect all of society, but it does affect like 40% of it or something. It's significant. There is the fact that things like PPP loans and that sort of stuff has dried up. Other forms of investment has dried up. Local investments, which have been able to kind of hoist stuff up through federal block grants and stuff that had came through COVID, is drying up. So, and all the programs that we were sold by Democrats in 2020 that were going to be, they were going to try to long term, they achieved almost none of that. A few of those things did get put into the Inflation Reduction Act. Inflation has more or less seemingly stabilized for now. I don't know how long that's going to stay.
I think it's entirely possible we shift into deflation sooner rather than later. The way that, like, funny thing that happened is that, like, you remember everybody talking about the bullwhip effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the supply chain crisis. Well, now we're at the very, very end of that. That the lesson that everybody learned was not really a lesson, but what ended up happening is that everybody now that like the supply chain kinks are gone has a lot more inventory than they did before the crisis. And this like more inventory like that has to like be absorbed somehow, you know? This
you have to absorb the cost of maintaining the inventory. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, and there's still areas where that's breaking down. See what I was talking about with cars, but it's, the idea that we're going to return back to, like, we might see deflation, we might not. What we might see is radical sectional decoupling. So you might see, like, inflation in certain key commodities like food, and radical deflation and other things. For example, I don't know how the car industry is going to maintain itself if its prices stay at it is and it's only building luxury cars. Like, I don't think there is a demand to keep a whole lot of that industry open with that kind of pricing model. Like, and an unwillingness to, you know, manufacture economy, still probably $35,000 to $40,000 cars because the profit margins on those cars are so low. And this is what I keep pushing back on with the, like, when I look at this piecemeal, when I look at actual individual, like, commodities, I'm like, most physical commodities have lower and lower returns. And we'll get to this because this is going to get complicated. The whole rentier economy that venture capital was maintaining, where people were leveraging profits off of death, off of debts as a way of avoiding taxes, you know, actually, I don't think people realize that's what it does. Like, if you can eke out just enough profit to outpace your debt, you can also hide your earnings by taking on additional debt, which these rentier companies were clearly doing. And that led to, you know, the theories everybody was talking about 3 years ago, and somehow some leftists are still pretending that they're like neo-feudalism or whatever, which to me is laughable after, you know, 2022 to be maintaining that thesis. But when I look at all this right now, I have to put an asterisk on all of it, because this stuff with the petite bourgeois seems to me volatile as fuck and highly unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
Because one thing that we can say about the professional end of the petite bourgeoisie, what we might call the PMC, or I like to call the PMS, the professional managerial strata, is that there's a real sense that government largesse is holding those people up through government contracts, through indirect investment, etc. And there's a real sense that also, despite the fact that, like, the GOP likes to poke at those people, they really don't actually want to damage that infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so you have that political base, but a lot of those institutions, frankly, are becoming less and less relevant. For example, higher education, which I don't think we're going to do away with, but it's going to be a smaller and smaller portion of our economy. Like, I think that's kind of undeniable at this point. Like,
yeah, I mean, we've already seen the peak of college, like, graduates and stuff. And but to go back to what you were saying about, like, the, like, how volatile it is.
Mm-hmm.
One thing to keep in mind, like, there was, like, I first saw this paper a few years ago about profit rate distributions. And it was looking at, like, for most companies, private companies, we have no idea. But for public companies, we do know. And there's some databases of public company data that go back to, like, I don't know, the 60s or something. And if you plot the distribution of profit rates for all the public companies and you look at it over the years, how that distribution's changed, you can see that the tail end, the negative, the side that is on the lower half of the profit rate distribution is, for public companies, it's basically a triangle of a logarithmic triangle. It keeps going lower and lower and lower. So you have, like, this came back to relevancy just a few weeks ago when Goldman Sachs put out a graph that showed this, like, what is the share of negatively profitable public companies over time? And it's since the 60s, it's been, and particularly since, like, the 70s, it's been going up and up and up. And right now it's at, like, 50% of all public companies are not profitable. That's a crazy statistic. If you think about that in terms of like here's the thing with like the rentierism kind of thing, right? Is that it's always like a double-edged sword, and it's a delicate thing too, because it was always kind of dependent on profit rates, or not profit rates, but on interest rates.
Yeah.
Because who can be the rentier is entirely dependent on the interest rates. Because if it's low, then it's exactly what you're talking about. The debtor gets to be the rentier. It's all of these companies that with negative profit rates and so on that are living off of these new dollars created by credit, who are living off of like the irrational excesses of capitalism and speculation and so on. But as soon as profit rates go up, and it's like it's right now, and we haven't even really seen like the other foot, like the other shoe fall, because interest rates are so high, are choosing not to get more debt. They're trying to avoid it as much as possible. They're trying to lock in the low interest rates they had before. But eventually that's not going to be feasible anymore. And it's why we're seeing like, YouTube is forcing people to get off their ad blockers and stuff. It's why, the thing with Twitter is that like Musk made a horrible business decision in buying at such a high price. But it's the same kind of logic, is that he needs to get like more operating income in order to make this work with the debt that he has. The rentier shifts from the creditor or from the debtor to the creditor when you have the higher interest rates go up. That's why it's like such a delicate thing, and why it's like these distributional effects are really important for capitalist economies, because it shifts where the excess is and where like the resources are going.
This is actually really crucial, because I think that's going to change a lot of politics. If these rentier companies are also thus drying up, and I think we've seen, like, for me, when Ackerman and co try to convince me that there's no declining rates of profits, and I'm like, well, okay, why is mass media failing? Why are we reaching all these profitability things in areas of excess? Why is it not just, why is it happening in places outside of the United States? If it's just a currency policy problem, why do we see similar trends happening in China and Russia? I mean, the ruble fell through the floor this year. Mm-hmm. Like, and most people didn't notice it. It's actually quite interesting reading economic analysis right now on both the right and the left, because it's usually like a year and a half out of date what they're saying is going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I admit, yes, there is something very frustrating to the constant predictions of the final crisis the next day. And like you and I both are hesitant to do that. For one, countervailing tendencies emerge all over the place in ways we don't see. That's how neoliberalism happened in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
That's also how Keynesianism became viable. And there's always a prediction to declare in the midst of that, that all these trends are done, that like, monopoly capital exists. We don't have to worry about the crime rate for profit anymore. 1950s, 1960s, mm-hmm. Neoliberalism exists. We don't like, we can immiserate and austerity our way out of the decline rates of profit. Somehow that prevents revolutionary subjectivity. I don't know how, but that was the argument. Now I don't, neo-feudalism or political capitalism or whatever is forestalling it, or the idea that just monetary flows can handle the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll hear, predictions of like, well, de-dollarization is happening tomorrow. I think Michael Hudson has literally said this every month for 2 years now. And while there has been significant de-dollarization just because of the value of the dollar going up, it hasn't really led to like the weakness of the U.S. trade capacity at all.
Yeah. You know, this is go ahead. This has been what my instincts have been for this, like ever since I kind of started thinking about economics and socialist politics and stuff. When I was like a bushy-tailed undergrad, I came up with this idea that wrote this really terrible paper based off of it for a class about how there are these trade-offs in capitalist regulation of economies. That like this, like you keep coming up with these new solutions, but they create, they create new problems, but you can't ever escape these fundamental trade-offs in how you deal with the capitalist economy. And I still think that's true. I think that, like, and I mentioned this when we had our discussion on like the right after the bank started failing and the Silicon Valley Bank and stuff. Like there were serious problems, but the overall, I didn't think it was going to cause like a cascading failure necessarily. Like even today, the economic outlook is still very mixed. I don't see like the Great Depression 2 happening right around the corner. Although certainly there are such like things that could trip things up somehow, like auto loans are a big example.
Auto loans, commercial real estate. There's a lot of
blow up. There's big problems in the economy. I don't know if they'll cause things to explode or not necessarily. But what I do know for a fact is that there are even if the next recession isn't like a final crisis of capitalism, I do believe final crises of capitalism exist. We saw one in the 70s, and what they are is the crisis of profitability. That eventually this is what pushing up against the limits of these trade-offs actually looks like if you're interested in like the welfare of society. Because once you hit that point, and this is what makes the Keynesians so irresponsible, in my opinion, is that by thinking that you can always just regulate out of like these problems to just always have more prosperity and so on. No, at some point you run into this comes into conflict with the reproduction of the capitalist class, and that's what we saw. And nobody, none of the Keynesians and Ackerman aren't talking about this. They never admit it. When I confront them about it, they don't even address it. Because it's not like that. This is not even like in the realm of things to talk about in economics, you know?
Yeah, well, this is something I brought up to MMTers where I'm like, okay, what if you're correct? What if everything you're saying is true? And yet, there is no way in which the power relationships of the policy you want would be maintainable if we had full employment, for example. Yes, all Marxists should advocate for full employment because we know damn well, I mean, Marx said, be careful about that. Be careful about promising it because we know damn well that under capital, that would be a disaster for the capitalist. It would be like it would.
Yeah.
Having no elasticity in the labor market would effectively, tip the bargaining power to labor to a point that it could totally dip into the profitability. There's no way around that.
And there's knockoff effects there too. I mean, one of the reasons the national workshops were so important in like the Second French Republic for the socialists is because they were like stimulated worker organizing extraordinarily. And so does having full employment. Like you actually have all these people working in cooperations and they have tight labor markets.
We are seeing so many strikes right now. Let's be honest, because they can. Like, there's less scabs to scab on you right now.
Yeah, exactly. But I saw this this paper that was I don't think it was very intellectually deep, but it was one of those papers that's like trying to summarize and combine a bunch of different ideas and so on, basically trying to combine degrowth and MMT to get like just climate transition or whatever, right?
You mean so someone like Jason Hinkle?
Maybe.
That sounds like his. Go ahead. That just sounds like his deal.
I can't remember who the author was. That might have been it. But it was just so pie in the sky, like just wishful thinking, because they're like, oh. Well, if we institute price controls and when we do the stimulative spending, we can control the like the inflation is like what is a that could result from this. And it's just, do you not understand
that the amount of control over the economy they're actually positing would require more than what Marxists would require for a communist revolution, and they're just not being honest about it.
Like, exactly. Like, there's no way this will ever work if you don't have direct control over production. It, like, as soon as you do something like this, you're going to open up black markets. People are just going to find ways around this. It's not it's not a serious policy solution to it's just wishful thinking that if you can combine all these different ideas to get exactly what you want.
So, yeah, you have to target investment. You have to tax the shit out of people. You have to and hope that that doesn't lead to political backlash, which it will. You have to, like, there's a reason, for example, that almost all Keynesians have effectively given up the primary inflation control that Keynes thought existed, which is taxation.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why they've given it up. And there's a reason why, for example, Ackerman and up, not this has nothing to do with what you were arguing with him about, but in the past, he's like, well, inflation is good for the working class. That was, you know, 2 years ago, that was like every article he was writing.
Uh-huh.
And as long as it doesn't get above, like, what is it? Like 12% or something. And I'm like, only if you think the working class are debtors, which I don't, like, there's a confusion of categories there, my friend.
Yeah, I mean, the middle class has way more debt than, like, middle class is nebulous, but, like, middle income earners, like, these are much more likely to benefit than, like, people who are really just scraping by with, like, wages and so on. Because you need assets to have liabilities. Like large liabilities,
right? Exactly. You have to have assets. You have to be. There's a way in which people are playing around with. I mean, middle class is nebulous, but like playing around with moving the image of the middle class worker and the working poor.
Yeah.
So that you're not like always shuffling around who's being helped where, and. I think this is a pretty big problem because, like I've said, I don't necessarily disagree with what MMTers have to say about money and currency.
Mm-hmm.
I disagree with them on what that means about production and power relationships. And a lot of what they're actually advocating for, if you think about it, requires a vast managerial class beyond even what the Soviet Union or China, when it was trying full communism, ever had.
Mm-hmm.
Targeted technocratic fiscal and monetary policy.
And you need like new techniques for like coordinating production too, that they don't talk about what those would be. Because, like, if you're doing price controls and stuff, and also trying to stimulate investment through like extra government spending, the primary way that it, like the industries shift, like they're in like reallocate sectorally, is through price changes. If you take that away, like, there's going to be all kinds of messiness that you're not even anticipating right now, and aren't dealing with conceptually.
Absolutely. So. This means that right now it seems like the most connected part of the class, to tie this back into your stuff, and then we'll get to talking about the Fed and your current thesis about how that works, but that the people most activated by this is the petite bourgeoisie, particularly the petite bourgeoisie and the what let's call the middle tier petite bourgeoisie, who also tend to be tied into Sunbelt production, that are downwardly mobile as both individuals and a class, who tax rates really are an existential threat to their profit rates and thus their ability to socially reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that they are not for everybody else. I mean, let's be honest. While there's a ton of taxes that hit the poor, actual income tax doesn't that much. And the poor by definition don't tend to have a whole lot of other profits to go after. And so they get hit by other things, hidden fees, service taxes like Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security. But even those are limited, you know, because they're bracket capped. Whereas the petite bourgeois who make $100,000 to $200,000 a year, and they're who are theoretically comfortable. And yes, I you're right that these people are about 60% GOP. They are still probably a large part of the more conservative end of the Democrat base, depending on if they're urban or not.
I mean, here's the thing, is that they're especially important for party politics because they're the people who can participate. They have like some kind of independent wealth. They have like they're the ones who are pulling things in regional and state parties, basically.
Absolutely. Right. Basically, yeah. For both parties. They are the people participating in municipal politics, which is the basis of politics, whether we like it or not. Mm-hmm. And no one else really has the time, the inclination, or the ability, particularly now because of profitability rates, things like local media and whatnot are completely non-viable. I mean, I like to, when people talk to me about this, I always remind them about my podcast. My podcast is profitable. I mean, I do have headway. I don't have a ton, but like it's profitable because my audience is all over the world. It is diffuse. But if I tried to survive off of my local audience and be a local oriented Marxist entertainment podcast or whatever,
handing out VHS tapes.
Yeah. Or even just like, I'm just focusing on my local polity here on the internet and that's all I want. Mm-hmm. I would not be viable. There's no way. Right. Diffusion is how this kind of, you know, rentier quasi-capitalism works. Now, people should think about that across the board because it makes it look like we're able to build more than we can, because you used to be able to support media apparatuses with staffs, all right, off of local advertising.
Yeah.
That is not possible now. Which also means that you need more overhead to even have the knowledge base about local politics to participate in it meaningfully.
Yep.
I don't just mean running or giving to candidates. Like, even knowing who the candidates are is harder than it used to be because people like me aren't covering them because there's no profit base for us to do so. Mm-hmm. And so when I hear that, like, there's no profitability problem, I'm like, then explain to me why the economy works the way it does right now. And you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Or you'll say, well, we're not doing the investment, you know, correctly. This is actually what I get from MTers, you know, if we focus, and I'm like, well, how do you focus that cleanly? With what mechanism do you actually do planning only by monetary and fiscal policy that directly? You can't control that like that.
Mm-hmm.
At what point is using this intermediary of money as a power lever actually not that efficient? You know, it's not to say that you can't, but there seems to be a bait and switch on the general, we print more money, we can stimulate stuff, and the specific on how we coordinate, how we plan, how we'd stop, you know, how we'd manage the economy to deal with when it gets overheated and thus inflationary or whatever. Like, all these things are questions that are theoretically addressed in the abstract, kind of, and then dropped out. And that seems to be a left-wing move. And it's always seemed to me to be a progressive move, but I've seen, quote, social democratic Marxists increasingly do it. Why do I say it's a progressive move? Because the progressive attitude has always been very similar to the Bernsteinian attitude, but even more vulgar in a lot of ways, that we could just regulate our way there. Right.
Yeah.
And for one, I don't mean to give conservatives much heed, but that level of regulation is absurd.
Like, yeah. I mean, it's one of the, like, I don't know, there's lots of, I think it's one reason that, like, there is, like, this gap between, like, this, you see the decline of the small businesses. They're, like, 1 to 5 people, and then all the other kind of businesses, like, small, medium businesses, are increasing over most of, like, the history that we have. Is that, I mean, regulation is, like, a real thing. Like, people, I mean, I obviously have, like, an affection for a bureaucracy, but I obviously, filling out forms and trying and red tape is annoying in general. And the simplest way to, like, the simplest way to accomplish lots, and some people talk about it, like, oh, we could start, like, a public company that does certain things, model it off after, like, post service or different public corporations. And that would be great. I think that, but I don't know, I think that the thing that a lot of people just don't, well, actually, let me rewind a bit, because this actually relates to, like, the deeper thing here, which is, and this is a problem that Marxists have as well, in a much more sophisticated and twisted kind of form, is that we don't really have very sophisticated theories of the state. That this is anywhere in, like, across the political spectrum, I think. Because if you do have a good theory of the state, of how, like, social institutions function and how they form and reproduce themselves, then you can start to answer some of these questions. Well, how do you do X? And some of these things are, like, trans-historical, you know, like, you create social institutions to do these things. But the problem for everyone is that nobody really understands how those things are connected to economics, to not just capital surplus, but surplus in general, how these things relate to historical tendencies of, like, the state to form and what its internal logics are.
And unfortunately, I think Marxists have largely actually left that primarily to anarchist anthropologists, frankly, who are the only people who seem to talk about surplus in this way. And I guess Bataille, like, you know, but I actually agree. We have to look at, like, trans-historical tendencies. We have to look at game theoretical outcomes. Like, as much as I and you disagree on Althusser, it attempts a theory of the state. I think his theory is nascent at best, but at least he kind of has one. Marx avoids the question. I mean, he does. It is something that originally he planned on doing. Mm-hmm. He never got there. It has not worked out. Like, and I think it does show up in so much that Marx has a theory of the state. It usually is implicated in his debates with either Blanquiist on one side or anarchist, usually Bakunin anarchist or Proudhon anarchist on the other.
Mm-hmm.
Where you get a nascent idea of what he means by, like, dictatorship of the proletariat, a state to stateless society. You know, and Lenin does what he can to work that out. But again, at this point, I think we can all agree that those understandings, while there might not be anything wrong with them, they're not sufficient. They may be mm-hmm. necessary, but they're not sufficient in explaining what we see in the modern state. And then we have to start dealing with counter institutions, and you'll get things like dual power. Well, fine, but how does dual power handle the scale difference today? Or, you know what? You know who is able to do dual power better than the working class right now? The petty bourgeoisie, because mm-hmm. they are more willing to be class collaborationists to maintain whatever vision of the status quo they have in their head.
I mean, this is exactly, like, why I wrote that article in the petty bourgeois, is that they, like, I was revisiting my priors of like of Marks, because I realized, like, for the longest time, I was still committed to the idea that we could reverse these tendencies of like atomization, and somehow that like the recreation of monopoly capital will reestablish the tendencies that Marx identified of the socialization of labor, centralization, the expropriation of capitalists by a smaller number of capitalists, and so on. But as that's not happening again, this time because of petty bourgeois power, I was thinking, well, let's go back to the drawing board here for a second. What is this problem here? Why is like, this was like something that has always been a thorn in my side that I'm trying to address. It's like, how do we think about the petty bourgeois? Let's not just, let's go back to the basics and try to figure this out. And unlike just what Marx was doing in Capital, trying to work this through a theory of the state. And what I realized is that if you, like this thing that Althusser identifies, this that I always come back to, the relative maximization of violence, or potential violence, depending on how you want to think about it, is this transhistorical tendency of the state, of how states, not just like a particular state, but as states throughout history, because you can have states that actually fail to in the ascendancy and they get destroyed usually. And the reason that's important is because it's the same thing that Marx, like everybody identifies this in like the moments of defeat, you know, that Marx saw this after the failure of the Second French Revolution. And then Adorno and the Frankfurt School people are talking about the same kind of thing after World War II. And like the after post-Stalin secret speech stuff. Is that when you see that, like the history of like increasing, like he talks about like from like throwing like the, I forget what the first thing was, like a stone or something to the atom bomb, the slingshot to the atom bomb, I think it was, like this tendency to create more refined and powerful apparatuses of violence. Marx was actually kind of talking about the opposite, but he was talking about the increasing perfection of the state through the centralization of the French state, through the first revolution, the first Napoleon, and then the second revolution, the second Napoleon. And these things are all connected, is what Althusser is saying, is that in his final critique of Marx in trying to create this theory of the state. He's saying that you have, on the one hand, these increasingly refined methods of social control and political power in the state, in creating ideology and so on. And then also the more refined and powerful methods of actual violence. And this is connected to decrease the violence of all other actors on the one hand and increase the violence of the state. And when you realize that, and you think about this in an evolutionary framework of the state, the problem of the petty bourgeois makes a lot more sense. Because in order to get to like each of these things that happened, when you had the failure of the 1848 revolutions, and then you had what appeared to be like the failures of Stalinist communism, and then also like the hopes of the Second International and so on, these things like were attached to like, well, first was like the failure of like the bourgeoisie to create a liberatory politics, right? Mm-hmm. And then it was like the failure of the proletariat, or the failure of the bourgeoisie, then the failure of the proletariat to create liberation and so on. But these things, and I had this phrase in the article that like everybody gets the unfreedom they deserve, in the sense that like everybody's political actions to get their freedom as a class creates a particular kind of state that is capable of suppressing them, mm-hmm, as like violent actors and so on. And this is like what This is what the revolutionary potential of the petty bourgeoisie is. Is it at some point in this process of like once we see what the crisis of the petty bourgeoisie is, it's like it's going to be exist economically, but it'll have a political dimension that is equally important. And when that happens, there is a crisis for the state as well, that it has to adapt and overcome this somehow, whether it's be through like, and this is talking about the state, it's like a species of social organization. So individual states may fail, like the including like the bourgeois state is a general category. What you have to, I think that you can't, if you can't escape these kind of tendencies in history, so long as like the state exists, you have to do like a meta analysis of how you respond to a crisis to get the outcomes that you want. And if you can't get like, if you know that the state is going to find a way to deal with this problem, you have to try to find the solution out of like the sample set of solutions that is most aligned with what you're interested in. That makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I mean, this is why I'm so interested in studying state formation, surplus formation, social institutions that arise out of surplus. And by surplus here, I don't mean like surplus capital, a la Capital Volume 1 through 3. I mean physical surplus general without even dealing with value categories. Mm-hmm. Like, it's something that you have to look at. And you have to start gaming out what's going to happen. What are the incentive structures? What kinds of social, geographical, interpersonal, intersocial factors lead to X? And if you can't do that, if mm-hmm. you don't have models for that beyond, beyond very basic ones, you're going to be kind of at Schitt's Creek. And it is actually, to me, the problem of Bonapartism, which I admit for Marx was a post hoc adjustment to his theory. Mm-hmm. Right.
It's very funny reading what he was hoping was going to happen at the start of the Second French Revolution and then what actually happens. And he's responding to it in real time.
Right. Yeah. And I don't, when I say it's post-hoc, I'm not even here saying that it's necessarily bad. He's trying to reconceptualize what is going on mm-hmm. in real time as he's observing it from England, in journalism, in his polemics in the First International, et cetera.
He was in France for the first part of it. And then, by the time Bonaparte came to power, I think he was out.
But yeah, it's, So I find this very, very interesting, though, because this is where you start seeing something like a state theory. You start seeing the dealing with problem classes. So we have the two driving classes, but there's all these. It's John Elster, not a guy I particularly like, but who did actually count the different class categories that show up in Marx. He counts 16 of them. And then if you take what Clive Burrow says is the two distinctions between true lumpen and semi-lumpen are, lumpen so-called, which are categories he derives from the letters.
It reminds me of that reporter like asking Biden how many genders are there, and he replies at least three.
Right. you get a ton coming out of this, and a lot of people have to like fix the categories in some way. I mean, Clive Burrow, for example, says lumpen proletariat was never meant to be a class. Well, Marx doesn't say that, although that is consistent with what Marx wrote, because mm-hmm. there's two theories of what causes people to be lumpen. The first one is just the decayed social classes of prior social orders, which, okay, you can't explain all lumpenness now that we're 150 years in capital that way, or 400 years in, depending on how you're counting. Or it's like people who are thrown into unclear positions in the work, from all classes and thus have to parasite on this. Marx isn't consistent on it, but he is working something out about state dependency, because one thing that I think Marxists today miss, but is something that Marx was very, you know, big on, is like, yes, there has to be a seizure of the state, but socialist and workers being dependent on the state before that seizure is actually a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something Marx wants. And his electoral strategy, both in the First International and in his advice to the SPD and letters, is pretty clear. Like, you don't fund a government. Like, you don't get in their way if they're helping workers, but you don't even take ownership of that, because eventually it's going to be used for control and it's going to put you in a bad position.
Yeah, it's funny, because I've been thinking about, like, what we were talking about, the critique of the Gotha program the other week, or some.
We were talking about it privately. We still have to do that episode, but
yeah. But one, this is a very tangential thing about it, is that he mentions in, like, I think it's one of the footnotes or something, or one of the after parts of it, where he says that, like, the they shouldn't support like the abolition of, like, child labor. So, like, obviously, like, against, like, the excesses of it and so on, but, like, that it's good for kids to have have experience working in things, because it gives them agency and he actually, like, has his, like, ideas of, like, actualization and independence of people and of working people, you know? And I think that's consistent with what you were talking about. Like people talk today about, like, how people are like so unprepared for the real world now, that, like, the way that education works, the way that people going through college and so on. I've talked about how, like, the how universities and stuff operate as, like, a state ideological apparatus, and, like, in line with Althusser. I think that in a lot of ways, our society is we've been dealing, like, the way that capitalist states have adapted to, like, modern, like, because they're always creating these new hot fixes, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like this too many. This, like, this, like, it keeps accumulating and coming up with new. Like, every time you add something on, not sure if it'll break something else, you know, like if you're trying to debug spaghetti code or something. And in a lot of the, and this is, I think you can, like, a lot of the evolutionary adaptations it has, like, came up with something to solve this particular crisis. And then it came up with this new thing to come up with, solve the next crisis and so on. The colleges and stuff came for, like, very important in the 20th century to solve, like, the problems of the revolutionary proletariat, I think.
Well, it gets rid of a whole lot of people from the labor market. It also enables, it divides the proletariat up and cartelizes things that you normally couldn't cartelize. It also is a way for the capitalist class to outsource and rent seek on training, and you know, outsource that to the proletariat, you know, even a skilled, protected, cartelized labor aristocratic part of the proletariat itself. I mean, like, there's a ton of things it does. I mean, and I have been reading more and more of these sections of Theories of Surplus Value in Capital Volume 3, when Marx talks about, like, how pre-capitalist formations actually survive all the time in capital, but they change their social orientation changes what they do. And I've been thinking a lot about that in regards to universities, in regards to banking. He talks about this in regards to, like, usury, actually. He's like, he was talking about the change in functions of, like, of a banking between late medieval and capitalist production, even though he's, you know, saying he's well aware that it was, you know, banking's crucial for capitalism, but it definitely existed for different reasons.
I mean, and I was going to get to banking too here, because it's one of these, it's one of the places where we most clearly see like adaptations by the state to these kind of crises.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think we've seen since 1981, mm-hmm. we've seen several radical but stealthy reorganizations of banking.
Right.
So let's talk about that, because this is another article you were writing, but I think it's really important.
Yeah. Now, so like in the '80s, like you, like one of the big things that happens is you have the savings and loan crisis. You have lots of centralization. This paves the way for a lot of globalization that comes later, because now you have like these really big banks that are the sponsors, the creators of these new, very liquid international markets of different assets of like state bonds and equities and all these international companies and so on, derivatives markets, Forex, so on. All of that, all the big international supply chains needed this to exist. Mm-hmm. What you have, and then you have like the 08 crisis, radically reorganized banking. You had QE and so on. Like a lot of interesting, like little hangovers. Like it's very interesting. Like the current situation we're in right now, the reason, like the thing I wrote that article to highlight what was going on was because nobody who caused it to happen in like 08 seemed to think about this as a consequence, because it like the whole framework that they were operating in never would have even happened. And it didn't happen for a long time because everybody was so worried about liquidity and like the super low interest rates after the Great Recession that lasted for so long that like nobody thought to think about, well, like, because what happened in 08 is that you had a transition away from controlling banks, like the lending of banks and their interest rates, controlling like the safest interest rate that they had, by basically buying and selling treasuries and altering their reserves through that. It was kind of a funky like way of doing it, but that's what they did. So you weren't the Fed really wasn't, there were certain small situations where they were doing like repos and stuff, and they were paying banks directly. But overall that wasn't the case. After 08, they started, they changed it so that the safest interest rate that banks had was the interest rate they got paid on their reserves, that they put at the Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve basically has bank accounts for all of the major banks. And the interest rate that they give those banks is basically the interest rate for is the Fed funds rate for the overall economy. And this is how they manipulate interest rates now. And because of that, when you have rising interest rates, you can have a situation where the Fed is actually paying a lot of money directly to these banks.
Right. Well, what I found interesting about your argument there is it sounds like it's similar to what Warren Mosler would argue, that the payouts on the interest rates are holding up the entire economy. That's not what you're arguing, and I want to make that clear. Mosler is basically arguing that's why we don't have an unemployment crisis, is the backdoor payouts on these interest rates. But I'm like, that only goes to banks. It doesn't necessarily go to places to give out payroll. So I don't know if that's actually true. But there is a sense in which the banks are being supported by the payouts on these interest rates.
I did the math that, like, if you take away those interest rates right now, they would be making, they would all, like, most of the big banks would be in negative profitability territory, and the ones that aren't would be pretty close. If they had, like, this is a particular consequence of this particular economic policy or monetary policy framework. It didn't have to be this way, but while I don't know how, like, what the exact, like, what a different path would look like, it's certainly the case that, like, the these interest payouts to banks probably did help a lot in preventing, like, the spread of the Silicon Valley Bank collapse. And,
We didn't have a crypto induced savings and loans crisis, basically.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's still really big problems for banks right now because interest rates are so high. A lot of the assets that they're holding are worth way less than what they paid for them. And if they tried to sell them, they would have big losses on their statements. They're not selling them, but they are. And if it came to that, the Fed would probably just buy them for them at higher prices to make sure that everything held together. But that would be a whole other kind of thing. Like the Fed is fixing these prices to, or in this hypothetical situation would be fixing prices to ensure the stability of the financial markets. So, like, the whole thing calls into question, why do we need these guys? Why do we need these big banks? Why does public monetary policy have to make private investors really wealthy, like the owners of these banks, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's just really absurd that that's how it continues to work.
Well, it does seem interesting to me that QE seems to have been a way to get rid of toxic assets, thus removing risk from the market and pumping asset values. Not by I agree with the MMTers. It wasn't by directly throwing money at the economy. It was by basically moving balance sheets around and creating asset protection for things that would otherwise have blown up. Like think of them as little asset bomb shelters. But they quit doing that because of inflation, and it makes sense because eventually you can't pump assets forever and it not eventually for some kind of exogenous shock flow out into the market. Like, mm-hmm. Eventually it's going to have to. Something, I don't know, COVID, whatever, can cause that to happen. Oil crisis, there's a war, all kinds of things that are happening right now could cause that to happen.
I mean, it's a really interesting, there's a really interesting dichotomy here, though, because going back to the profit rates for a second, is that there's a funny dynamic when you have rising asset prices, right? Mm-hmm. Because when, like, if you are, like, it's not boosting the income to the capitalist class as a whole, except to the extent to which there are non-capitalist asset holders who are like losing money relative to them. It's that, like, this is basically a thing that helps older capitalists in the market, the ones who already have assets. If you're a capitalist going into the market as a newcomer and you're having to pay relatively a lot to get access into this, and now your assets will be more worth more down the line, probably. That's actually, like, this obviously there's no guarantee, right? But the actual returns that you're getting on these things is like the income that you're getting out of it. It's just a funny game that you play when with asset inflation, right? Because in order for there to be, like, someone who gains off of it, there has to be a seller and a buyer, you know? Somebody has to be losing money off of this in order for it to work. If you try to get off this treadmill, of increasing assets and try to actually consume a lot of that wealth, it would, a lot of it
becomes fictitious. The moment you try to actually valorize it.
Exactly. I mean,
see what, like, and I admit, you know, there's a lot of pushback from MMTers about the idea of fictitious capital. But the way I just say is, look, if your balance sheet says one thing and when you go to try to sell it, most of that doesn't exist, because mm-hmm. your valuation was inaccurate to when you were valorizing the capital, then that was fictitious. It never existed.
Like, right.
But you can only know it though when you sell shit. So,
But the thing is with like profit rates is that even though there's lots of money being made in these financial markets, the actual like so it counts like the asset inflation in terms of rates of return, but the actual money that you can take out of the market is actually going down as a rate of like the which is like reflected in interest rates on bonds, on dividends, on stocks, and so on. Like the if you think about a rate of like the income return on an investment, excluding the asset price, because if you just roll it over, imagine you're like rolling it over indefinitely, right? The actual income that you're getting out of it is going to be decreasing over time with this kind of asset inflation, because the income is still determined by like what these companies are making. So you can have weird scenarios where like this, like these huge speculative energies going on in stock markets and so on. A lot of people are throwing their money away at it. The actual money in the economy is still in all these really big firms that do all the productive things, but they don't actually, like if you're a capitalist that's buying the stocks in that company, you have to pay a really high price for those, you know? You in order to get like whatever like the that makes it so that the dividends are a like socially adjusted return of like 5% or whatever, you know?
Whatever beats inflation. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a socially determined thing. It's why like it's actually a reason why for a long time people thought like that the equalization of profit rates was absolute, because it is absolute, absolutely equal on the financial level, because it's totally liquid like that and so on. But on actual returns of companies and so on, it's not.
I think this, however, makes it very clear, one, why the stakes around the state seem so high for both the petty bourgeoisie, for the PMS, for all these groups that are these like quasi categories right now, why there's such an incentive to turn even things that traditionally are workers into pseudo contractors, piece workers in a way that offsets losses, and why we see labor struggles. I mean, one of the things about current temporary labor structures, with the exception of the UAW, is a lot of what you're seeing right now is battles over small businesses. Their franchises are their small corporates. I mean, but they're small businesses effectively. And it's hard to deal with that. That's why they don't often get good contracts or whatever, because they can't really shut production down except at one site. Mm-hmm. And when you add all that together, we're in a very interesting time period, because it seems like, one, you're right, the petite bourgeoisie seem to dominate politics right now because they can participate. Two, you have a radicalized, broadly speaking, semi-skilled working class that has a lot of labor power right now. I mean, not a lot of market power, excuse me, not labor power, on the labor market. I mean, it always has labor power. That's what defines it. But it has a lot of market power in the labor market because of a decline in the workforce, like in very simple terms. And while adjustments in the economy have made that decline less, you know, less of a problem, they're also trying to up worker productivity rates, which were super high in like the aughts, but have been down now for like 15 years. Mm-hmm. They hit a peak, I think, around 2005. And pushing people towards that right now is about pushing people beyond, because the technical capacity, with the exception of help with AI, which has done some work reduction, really is still not there for a whole lot of the labor market. And you're just breaking the workers. So you're going to get more and more militancy that way. But they don't, interestingly, have, properly speaking, political representation. When we see what the Democrats actually do. Yes, they're kinder to labor in a lot of ways, and in the ways Biden was like reform the National Labor Relations Board, etc. But that's mostly through executive fiat that hasn't been through legislative action. Mm-hmm. And it's limited to a fairly small set of workers when you actually look who's covered by the Labor Relations Board. It's, you know, it's a subset of a subset of workers. You know, when you figure out that most workers aren't in unions, but most union workers actually are exempted from the NCLB in some way. I mean, all state employees, for example, are. It becomes very clear that there's a real big limit to what's going on there. And what's still driving things is trying to keep the petite bourgeoisie at bay. And it doesn't seem to, and I'm going to be frank here, both parties seem to be having massive political crises right now on how to handle it, and increasingly investing into Bonapartist figures because their entire political machine, mm-hmm. In the legislative branches, at the state level, et cetera, seems to be breaking down.
I mean, that's the thing about the, like, why I brought up the atomization of this class, that they, like, they, all of the social techno, like, this, some, there is some overlap in the social technologies that were created to deal with both the workers and the high bourgeoisie and whatever, there's not a particular social technology built to deal with this, of how to, like, the bourgeois state was supposed to have moved beyond Bonaparte, you know?
It's supposed to have developed. Yeah, that was the whole, at post-World War II, post-war state is supposed to be to get us beyond this problem.
Yeah, exactly. But because of the way that the petty bourgeois works is, because of their atomization, because they can't, like, you can't use these institutions to control them if they don't participate in them, you know? Like, they participate in the state and the parties and stuff, but they're not, like, in terms of, like, the universities, the media, the, like, they're creating all of these counter, like, media networks and stuff because they're not being directly connected into these existing networks and institutions. They haven't developed a set of, like, policy tools and structures to deal with them.
Basically, all they can do is disrupt, but they can disrupt. And that's the thing that I think, which makes them a political actor, because it can gum up the machine. But what is the petite bourgeois political vision? Other than trying to maintain something about the status quo, it's not even consistent amongst the class, because it can't be. Different parts of petite bourgeois are going to need different things. And that leads to a kind of incoherence that can only be papered over by administrative fiat, but that's only viable for so long. I mean, like,
here's the thing. Here's, like, the ultimate solution that you come to, and it comes, it's related to the disagreements that I kind of have with Brenner himself, but also Ackerman, that, like, there's a lot of the discussions recently have been about the connection between growth rates and profit rates. Mm-hmm. And on a cyclical level, we know that there is a very close connection, because, like, you know, if you have more sales, you generally have more profits. And there's a bunch of other reasons for this as well. Like, he also, from the, like, the classical price mechanism and so on, that more higher profit rates are going to generally lead to higher real output. Because people see that there's money to be made in creating commodities and so on. But on a secular level, there's no reason to expect that there is a particular connection between a one profit rate for society and one, like, average growth rate. Because it goes back to the Kolecki profit equations. In other words, it comes back to basic accounting. Like, the profits of society are always going to be equal in, like, the aggregate to the amount of investing and the amount of consumption of the capitalist class. And you can have that technically with any growth rate. Like, you could, and we can imagine, like, But obviously there are social institutional reasons why it's correlated with certain profit rates. Like if we have a society where we are firmly taking a big share of the pie and just giving it to capitalists, just because they're capitalists, because of it is now just an enshrined property relationship in the state that these people get this share of income or whatever, that's not necessarily going to be good for growth. It is like how, but it is a way to preserve bourgeois social relations through rentierism. And this is what I've been saying since from the very beginning. So I've been talking about like the petty bourgeois, that they can, the one way out of this is to create a society where like they, like the profit rates are no longer a thing, which is like an economic mechanism of exchange and coordination of investment and so on. They have to neuter it in order for them to maintain their social relations and their status in society.
Well, that does seem to leave us in quite a bind, honestly. And it leaves, I think it leaves Marxists in a particularly precarious place, because on one hand, we actually have the beginnings of a theory to understand the economic apparatus of which this works, but we have not been, or are afraid to develop a theory of the state that does not see, just use the state as our, as something we can seize and use as a method for our own control. Like, which I think is like, yeah, sure, that's a goal, but that doesn't explain anything about what's going on right now or your own role in it. And that's my challenge to people like Ackerman and Brenner and Riley. I was also dissatisfied with the Brenner and Riley thesis, as I've responded to it elsewhere. I thought there was insight in it. Like, you know, I stick by the phrase, the irony of political capitalism is it's basically Keynesianism that doesn't work. The whole fucking point of Keynesianism is to restore profitability by acting countercyclically, and this clearly doesn't do that. So it's not seemingly in a long-term sustainable way. And when we start adding the number of exogenous shocks, to use, you know, contemporary political economic language, by that I mean wars, climate crises, etc., we really need a more robust theory for this stuff, because there's a lot of stuff flying at us at once, and we're seeing old forms come back again. And I think, you know, to kind of end this off, I've been thinking about the last bits of writing by Mac Davis, you know, the Enigmas book, his last book, plus his very last piece of writing, you know, Thanatos.
I'm not familiar.
Well, he basically argues that like that you're seeing Bonapartism and the decline of collective rule everywhere. I mean, he even says it in China. And that it's making the entire political system more fragile. And he basically seemed very worried, you know, about the future as he was dying, about where the left was going to be able to handle this problem of the degrading of institutions, since we're also wedded to these institutions and don't seem to be able to figure out ways to be both counter-systemic and productive of a new kind of politics. The petite bourgeoisie, as you've said, can be counter-systemic, but it doesn't build anything with that counter-system. It can't. Yep. It is not in the position to, even if they wanted to, even if there was a concrete vision, they're not in a position to do that. They're too dependent on the current mechanisms of power. Which is the irony of, at least the irony of your thing. They're creating the very state that is crushing them, but they're the people creating it, actually.
Yeah.
Like, from everything from the ability of the state to do censorship, like, ironically, the ability to outsource so much of, you know, for the state to start muddling around in private corporations, which it's always done, frankly, to achieve ends through censorship, to get around, you know, censorship blocks that exist in constitutionally in the United States, you know, quasi-constitutionally in Europe, although they're much weaker. That's ironically been created by their own imperatives, yep. Right? That's what did that. And their response to that being used against them is to create new imperatives that will be used against them, but it doesn't create any new politics, and it can't. But the left right now seems to be totally divided on whether or not we're tailing the seeming counter-systemicness of this petite bourgeois vision or the progressive vision of a certain strata of professionals and capitalists who like, you know, large capital, basically, who have progressive social norms because it's good for growing markets, frankly, but do not necessarily have any vision beyond that. And we just seem to be stuck there in a kind of impasse between these two forces. And even though at a time where it does look like there's real working class militancy, and yet despite the left being bigger and being revitalized as a force during the aught teens, not seeming to be able to do anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that seems to be where we're at. And I do think a lot of it comes from, frankly, pushing economic just so stories to get out of the hard part of this problem, because this is a hard problem. Because let's say we do have a final crisis right now. All right. Let's say that actually exists. We have a true profitability crisis worldwide. That would do it. Right. And it actually happens. Right now, the reactionary forces would be in a much better advantage to take into some other form of barbarism than anything we want. Like,
nobody's really prepared for it again. Like, nobody was prepared for it the first time, and nobody's really talking about the possibility of it happening again. And nobody is prepared to, like, really deal with the petty bourgeois either.
And I feel like we get outflanked by people like Michael Lind.
Mm-hmm.
Like
I had a very pessimistic optimist. Like, oh, maybe you could tail the high bourgeoisie a bit to try to see if they'll do something about this, because it's a threat to their interests, kind of. But they didn't seem interested in doing very much at all.
They don't seem interested in even fight, as you said, to bring it all the way back to the beginning of the show. They don't even seem interested in fighting antitrust legislation enforcement. Like,
which is insane, kind of. But I mean, they'll lobby against it. They have no sense of, like, this is the other thing, is that I think that this is something I didn't understand when I was younger, but I think I understand now, that, like, it wasn't just like the state, like, figuring out how to deal with the proletariat. It also figured out how to deal with the high bourgeoisie. And that's what, like, the first, like, what that's what the original bourgeois revolutions were. The high bourgeoisie got the unfreedom they deserved. And this is what the result is. They don't have any, like, there is no high bourgeois political vision, and there hasn't been for over 100 years, because they fixed that. It's done. So they have no reason to deal with this except through the most mundane legal means that may go nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, this brings me back to a piece by Stephen Bertram Lee a while back, where he says, look, it looks like the bourgeoisie no longer has the capacity to actually perform its historic roles. And thus, it does seem stuck. I mean, you know, I hear the platypoid screaming regression, and maybe they're right. I don't know that framing it that way is necessarily helpful. But there does seem to be a real impasse here. And
well, this is what I was trying to get at earlier, which was that all these things are ways for society to better reproduce the relations of production. But at a certain point, if you keep getting better and better at that, you can't also forget just reproducing production. And if you do create an adaptation that interferes with that somehow, then you've got a big problem. And that's what the whole thing with the fetters of production are, that it's related to that. That, like, all of these adaptations that capitalism has done has been to, in order to preserve the bourgeoisie, have basically prevented, have created a limit on what it can, on its productive capacity, on what, on how it can grow its productive capacity, essentially. And this is the other argument I made in the Petty Bourgeois article, that if, and this is a big if, of course, but if there was an alternative system that worked anywhere in the world, it would be an existential threat to bourgeois society. Any place that could overcome this problem by just wiping the slate clean and not having to deal with these social classes would be, and have, you know, like a set of institutions that actually did reproduce itself effectively without like the same kind of problems that the Soviet Union did. It would overcome capitalism. It would be it would be a more, I use the word metastable solution.
Yeah.
But of course, how do you get there? You know, yeah. If there was a it's like all the fuel spent. Yes, if you could light another fire, it would burn much brighter, or whatever. But or I don't know. It's the fundamental problem that you can't get around. Of how do you create an alternative?
Yeah, it's it is a depressing problem to think about, but it's something that if socialist is going to mean anything in the 21st century, given the quote polycrises that we are dealing with right now, this is a challenge that we have to ask. Otherwise, we're going to be outflanked by an incoherent petite bourgeois force that also can't really even get its own means achieved. And yeah. Right now, we are clearly being outflanked. And in fact, I would argue a good portion of us have helped them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know, that.
Well, it's crazy because both sides, like all sides are basically doing this. Everybody's like the right is telling the petty bourgeoisie. The left is a big portion of the left is telling the petty bourgeoisie. Those that aren't really doing much of anything besides being a part of the existing state apparatus.
Right.
There is no like, I mean, I admire a cosmonaut for what they're trying to do, but it's like there is no like specific anti-systemic left force that has like a specific it's connected
right. That has a real political economic answer to these questions. Some of them have geopolitical analyses, and fine. I mean, some of that. You know, whether I don't agree with a lot of it, I agree with a lot of it. Sometimes it depends. But without a political economic basis, that doesn't actually mean that much. And by that, I mean understanding not just currency flows, like having a pretty robust understanding of class, of social reproduction, of the way this is even affecting like the way people organize themselves, the way people have relationships, it goes down the scale, and also the way the state is organizing. So like those two things have to be kind of viewed. And I just think we have a very naive view of the state right now. It tends to be either simplistically anarchistic about, you know, the state is violence, which okay, true, but also not particularly helpful about how to deal with it, or it sees the state as a lever which we can cleanly pull. I think that's what Ackerman's variety of socialism ultimately is right now, and it doesn't see how these counterfactuals are in better places to use that lever, and how decayed all the other major social forces are. And yet we, despite militancy, can't seem to do much about it. Like we can't, like you would think at this moment, this would be the moment for the beginnings of the mergers to get the left and the labor movement back together. And yet right now it feels really far apart. Like, yeah. Well, thank you, Nico, for that depressing conversation. I'm going to put the list of your articles. Most of these are available at the Prehistory of the Encounter, which is your Substack. All the articles that we mentioned are fully available for free. So while you should subscribe, you don't have to get this information. You can go read Nico's work here. You provide a lot of your articles are free on that site. So
yeah, I only marked one as paid, and then I kind of gave up on marking things as paid because I every time I think, oh, but I want people to read it. So yeah.
You can help support Nico learn how to be a better petit bourgeois himself, since he's clearly not good at it.
The worst petty bourgeois that ever lived.
Yeah. And on that note, thank you so much. People should check out. Do you have anything else you'd like to plug?
Nah, that's it.
All right.
Thank you for supporting VarmVlog. If you would like more, you can find our stream on YouTube under my name, C. Derek Varm. You can also find us on Patreon, where you can subscribe for early audio access, additional shows, unexpurged audios, Q&As with me on video, and other perks, such as access to our archives, etc. There are three levels of support. One level even gets you on Patreon shows. Occasionally here you will hear shows done with other creators. I hope you enjoy them. We'd like to thank our producer, Paul Channel Strip, and Bitter Lake and Jason Miles for making our intro and exit music. And thank you for all you do. If you can't support us financially, you can support us by leaving a review on iTunes or your pod catcher of choice. Have a great evening.